PPI.org.
Tune to Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Special thanks to Amber Johnson, who helped arrange this particular show. Tonight, we are going to be speaking with Ariel Gilbert, and Ariel is a beekeeper who happens to be blind. Good evening, Ariel.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I thought I would hear like an overwhelming amount of buzzing in the background, but I don't hear any, so you must be fine. So I want to talk a little bit about, well, a lot about beekeeping. But first, can you just talk a little bit about how you lost your disability? Because this does play in a little bit, because you weren't always blind and you did the beekeeping before you lost your vision.
Correct. I lost my vision when I was 34, which was 1988. I know how old I am. And it was due to over-the-counter eye drops, which I didn't know were tampered with, and they had lye in them instead of eye drops. It was about the same time as the Tylenol tampering.
I do remember. Lye. Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been very scary.
It was an abrupt change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Abrupt change for anybody. Well, I'm glad you're with us, and that's all you lost was your vision. Certainly people move on from there. So
yeah,
the beekeeping is just not new to you. You did it and before you lost your vision. So can you at least tell us how in the world did you decide that you were able to do this with no vision?
I think some of it has to, I have to go back in time to what spurred my interest in bees in the first place, which was when I was 10, there was a swarm of bees that landed in our backyard, and my grandfather knew a beekeeper in town, and he came, and I watched him remove the hive and take it home, and that sparked my interest in bees. And then when I was a junior in high school, I was reading through the Sears and Roebuck catalog and found that I could purchase the equipment and the bees through Sears. So that's what I did. That's how I got started.
So,
because at that time there weren't a lot of beekeepers around. It wasn't a very popular thing to do. And so it was, it was a little bit seat of the pants. There weren't a lot of books. There wasn't a lot of information, but there also weren't a lot of the health concerns and issues that we're dealing with now. But from the time I was in high school to the time I lost my sight, the number of bees that I kept expanding. At one point, I've had 10 hives and managed those. And, just was always fascinated with the biology and the products of the hive and, the bee behavior. So when I lost my sight, it was really one of the things that was really hard for me to let go of were my bees, but I needed to move them on because I didn't think at that point it was something that I'd be able to do, because it takes some visual information, visual feedback about what's happening, what you're seeing, what's going on inside the hive, in order to make decisions on what you do with it. And so I rehomed my hives, and then, you know, continually, blissfully on for 22, 23 years before it kind of dawned on me again. And what actually spurred it was a friend asked whether she could keep one of her hives on my property. And I thought, wow, that's perfect. I could have bees around me again. Mm-hmm. But somebody else would manage them. Mm-hmm. And that fell through. And that happening, having that fall through, I realized how disappointed I was, mm-hmm. and how much I wanted bees back in my life. And so then I was on a quest to find a way to make that happen. You know, that was sort of the tipping point for me of, I've got to get back into bees.
So then you decided that you would try it. What were the concerns you had going into it with no visions?
Well, biggest concern is visually what's going on. Mm-hmm. Second biggest concern is, you know, what's happening environmentally with the bees. And, you know, it's very different now managing a hive of bees than it was, you know, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, queens would live 5 or 6 years. You didn't have death from things like varroa mite and other, you know, diseases that have been a problem and an issue with bees, colony collapse disorder, which is like a combination of a cluster of things affecting the bees. So, you know, I was worried about it, but I found out that in my county, we have one of those most organized group of beekeepers in the entire country. Mm. And it turned out that in my own little town, there were about 60 beekeepers that were, it's a nice organized group. And I went to the first meeting and they weren't intimidated in the least that I was there. It was shocking.
I've never had that kind of experience.
It was, and one of the old time beekeepers came up to me and she said, "Have you ever read the book called The Beekeeper's Pupil?" And I said, "No." And it's about a blind beekeeper from the late 17th or early 18th century in France, who made observations which are valid today that people didn't understand about bee behavior. So it didn't turn out to be something that scared people away. And one person who's very experienced said, "Hey, how about if I'm your eyes and we work together?" So that's how I manage my hives. I do all the work. I physically manage my hives, but when I'm pulling out a frame, she can look at it and say, "Yeah, I see cells with, you know, 2-3 day old eggs in them, or here are the number of eggs, or this is the pattern of the eggs," you know, so that, you know, I have better concept of, you know, what I want to do and how I want to manage the space. Yeah.
Where do you keep your hives and how many do you have?
I keep them in my backyard. And they're about, you know, maybe 40 feet from our house. And I have two hives right now. This is early spring we're getting an early spring here. Mm-hmm. So I might expand it to a third hive, but probably will keep it at two. And I'm lucky this year that I have two hives that wintered over in our area. There's been about 70% loss of hives because of all the fires we've had for the past 3 years.
How many bees generally live in a hive?
It varies. It can be, you know, 10 to 30 to 50,000 bees. Depends on the time of year. Right now, things are building up. because it's spring. And it depends on, you know, how big the hive is itself. I've got one hive that's on the smaller side and one hive that's pretty big. And so, you know, that number will vary.
And do they kind of keep themselves separated? Do they know that I belong to this hive, not that one? They must be aware that there are other hives around them.
Oh, yeah. They know their hive. They know their hive by smell. They know their hive by location visually. They orient themselves as baby, you know, when they're first learning how to fly, they orient themselves to their particular hive. And once they've taken this orientation flight, they'll always come back to their own hive.
Ariel, can you talk to me about the hierarchy of bees? When you see a hive, what do we expect? How does this work?
When you see bees, 99.99% of the time, you're seeing female, the worker bees. And those are females, but they're not fertile. There's only one queen that lays eggs.
Okay.
And I'm talking generally. There are always little exceptions. Bees are always a big surprise. But yeah, so bees that you see out and about, those are the female worker bees. There are male bees. They're not very big in number. You start seeing them around springtime, and they're big. They're about half again the size of a worker bee. They got great big eyes and no stinger. There's no stinger on them. If you see a drone, you don't have to. That's what they're called. The boys are called drones. They have no stinger at all. Their only purpose in life is to go outside their own hive. There's a designated area called there's a drone congregation area, mm-hmm, where the female queens will fly to get fertilized. And so and it's never with the drones from their own hive.
So that's the drone's only purpose. Wow, I can say a lot about that one, but
well, and the other bad part is the worker bees have to take care of them. They have to feed them.
Oh, this is so wrong.
Get food for them and do all this stuff. But they get, you know, there's a little bit of payback in the fall when they're done with the drones. Uh-huh. And by the way, they'd be taking up too much energy. They push them out of the hive and they just die outside.
All right.
So that's sort of the end of the boys. So. And then as far as the queen goes, she is a little different than the worker bees, which are also female, in that they have to decide if they're going to make new queens by the time their eggs are either 1 to 3 days old.
How do they decide that?
They can't make a queen. They know. They just know. They're amazing. This is what, you know, the thing about bees that fascinates me is the more I know, the more I realize I don't know.
And does it matter how old the queen is?
You mean as she ages and
right,
as being part of the hive? Yeah, it does make a difference. Sometimes you'll start seeing an irregular laying pattern if you have an older queen. Or she may start shooting blanks, and the rest of the hive will decide that they need to create a new queen. So then they'll take one of these eggs that are less than 4 days old, and start feeding it continually royal jelly, and then that they make a special little cell for them, which is much bigger than a regular cell, you know, the hexagonal cells that you find in the regular comb. And they also have a pretty short gestation period. It's only 14 days. So whereas the other bees, it's a little longer. So generally they'll make multiple queens, and first queen out, she goes over and kills the other ones. And
brutal.
You have your first, your new queen.
Brutal.
And generally what happens when a hive swarms, which is how a hive reproduces, in the spring, they'll double in size, and half the hive will stay with the new queen, and half the hive will leave with the old queen.
Aww.
And look for a new residence. Yeah.
So at least the old queen doesn't get killed. Does she?
No. Okay. Even if the old queen is in the hive, sometimes you'll find her and they'll still take care of her, but, you know, they have a new queen and they sort of keep her off in the corner.
I see. Well, good to that they take care of her for all that she's done, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way. How many different kinds of bees are there?
Well, actually, there's thousands of native bees, but most of them are solitary. What's unique about the honeybee is that they live in a colony, and so they live as a group, and that social group is how they survive, whereas most other bees either live in the ground or they make mud nests or they're starting to get popular to get native bee houses, and they look like they're full of little tubes, and the native bees use those. Most of the time it's like mason bees and leaf cutter bees.
So are the native bees dangerous for the honeybees?
No, they aren't. They don't really have much to do with each other, and they actually forage usually different plants.
Ah, okay. Do the native bees create or make anything that is useful for humans, or are they just pollinating?
They're pretty much just pollinators.
Okay.
As far as, you know, the effect on us. They pollinate plants really well. but they don't, because they don't live in groups, they're solitary. They're not producing comb and saving nectar and pollen. So there aren't any products of the hive that you would find with honeybees.
Can you talk about what royal jelly is? It's something I hear about, and what it's useful for.
Royal jelly is what's fed to all bees when all the eggs that are produced, at least up for the first 3 days. After that, then the worker bees are fed nectar and pollen. Royal jelly is produced by the young bees that have recently hatched. They're called nurse bees. And that's a product that they can only produce for, I think it's about 7 to 10 days.
Ah.
And so I'm not exactly sure of the exact contents of royal jelly. I know there's protein in there and sugars, but I'm not exactly sure of, you know, everything that's in there. But yeah, the really young nurse bees, that's the first job that bees have after they're born, is to they produce this royal jelly and put that in all the cells with the eggs.
Okay, well, that's always good to know. So then the next thing that I'm curious of is, like, how do you interact with the bees, and what kind of things do you have to do to take care of them?
Well, first thing I do is I always plan my strategy of what I'm going to do, have all the equipment available to me, and I don't bother the bees unless I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided to get back into beekeeping, I knew that wearing gloves was going to be like wearing a blindfold, and I wouldn't have enough information. Mm-hmm. So I made the decision that I was going to always going to manage my bees barehanded.
Wow.
And I knew that
bold of you.
I'm going to get stung. Yes.
Right.
I'm going to get stung. Well, if you're a beekeeper, that is an advantage for me before, was you do get stung. It's just part of beekeeping. It happens. Not frequently, but it happens. So, you know, you kind of get used to the concept that it hurts like crazy for about 5 minutes, and then it's over and you move on. You know, you know what to expect. So I made that choice because I needed to be able to feel what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it wasn't enough information. And so I started that way. I also made a few, you know, I've learned, you know, after the hard way of, you know, I accidentally kept my fingers separated when I was going in to pull frames out and work with the bees, and discovered that, you know, just that slightest pressure, you might squish a bee that's between your fingers.
Oops.
And get stung, which I did, and then learned, okay, new technique, keep your fingers together.
Mm.
So I do that. I wear a veil, but I don't wear a suit. And so, and I'm comfortable with that. Everybody has to work with their bees the way they're comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm comfortable making sure my face and my head is protected, but I spend enough time with my bees and I'm really not worried about having contact with them. And depending on the time of year, it depends on what you're doing with your bees, but like, things building. They're producing wax now. They're saving pollen and nectar and really on the build. And so right now I am having to go in and evaluate how much space they have. Do they have enough room to grow, or are they going to get too cramped? And so I add frames where I need to add frames, and make sure that they have enough stores to eat. And then pretty much close it back up and leave them alone. And then I'll go back in probably every 7 to 10 days now until August.
So I'm going to stop you a minute. What's a frame?
Okay. Yep. That's a real fair question. I use what are called Langstroth hives, which is what most people use. It's the big white boxes that you see that have different sections on them. So those sections are called supers. So each box that has that stacked on each other, inside that box has between 8 and 10 what are called frames, which are like a wooden frame for a painting that has usually just wire that goes across, and sometimes they have what's called foundation, which can be made out of wax or plastic, and then that gives the bees something to build their honeycomb in, and then you're able to go in and manipulate those frames depending on what they need.
What do you feed your bees?
I don't feed my bees. The bees collect their own honey and pollen. And in the fall, when I'm getting ready to close my hives down for the winter, I make sure that they have enough of the honey that they've produced that will get them through the winter, so that I don't need to feed them anything, because I can't produce food that replicates what they've created from nature. Giving them sugar water is like which is what some beekeepers do. They remove all the honey because they want that. It's highly prized, it's valuable. But then they give them sugar water to eat, and that's like giving us a diet of Coke and, you know, Kool-Aid.
Oh,
and no nutrition. It has nothing in it. And so, you know, I feel like my job, even if I don't collect any honey for myself in a year, I don't care. All I care about is that they have the 20 to 30 pounds, depending on the size of the hive, that they need in order to go get through the winter. And that's my goal.
So how much honey do your bees usually produce? Does it vary?
It really varies a lot. Depends on, you know, what our weather is like and how much forage is created. Springtime for us, I'm on the West Coast. I'm in California. Mm-hmm. And so springtime for us is our big forage season. We get a lot of flowers till about June, but then we dry up and get a dearth, which means a dry season, till about September. And then we got another little section of rain, which will give us some more forage for the bees. But we like live in a desert in the summer, so I have to make sure that whatever they collect now till about June will get them through the summer. But sometimes there's so much, there's just a plethora of honey that they produce. It's far more than they need, and I'll remove that and leave them what they need. And same within the winter. You know, even if they produce 60, 80 pounds in one hive, I'll bring it down to 20 to 30, depending on the hive, and remove the rest of that honey, because that just becomes like a cold sink in the winter, where all that cold honey is just sitting there above the brood chamber, which is the chamber where the bees are living.
Theoretically, then you can sell that honey that's extra.
I tend to give it as gifts and use it myself. But I do a lot of it as gifts, because it's really nice to give people honey that, you know, comes from, it's local. Nothing's been done to it. It hasn't been heated. It hasn't been filtered. Nothing. It's just pure honey.
Do you taste the difference with honey of bees that are fed as opposed to ones that are not?
Yeah, you really can. That's one of the joys I have with being a beekeeper, is honey tasting. It's like wine. It's so subtle and nuanced with the different, what they call phenols, the different aromas that are created from the nectars that the bees collect. And last spring was just fascinating to me, because two hives right next to each other collected completely different honey. One honey ended up crystallizing very quickly. It just means mm-hmm. that it was a higher percentage of glucose than over fructose. It's normal. And then the other was completely clear and never crystallized. One tasted like anise, I mean, just really strong anise flavor. And the other was jasmine. I mean, it was clearly jasmine. The two hives weren't even 3 feet apart from each other.
Do you think that that was dependent on, like, what they were getting from the flowers, or what do you...
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, and... It's interesting because bees have preferences. You know, like we have preferences about food and what we like and smells that we enjoy. Bees have the same thing, and they get drawn to particular flowers and want to stay with that. You know, they'll go to all these different bushes of the same type of flower and bring it back, not go to random different bushes and taste different things and bring it back.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of how bees produce honey?
It's really interesting. They bring the nectar back from the flowers that they collect, mm-hmm. and they have a second stomach, and it's kind of hard. Kind of a misnomer to call it a stomach. It's labeled that way, but there's no digestive juices that are part of that. It's more like a holding tank.
Uh-huh.
Let's call it a holding tank.
Okay.
Yeah. So they bring the nectar back in this little holding tank that they have, and then they put it in particular cells in the frame, in the hive. And the moisture content, when they bring it back to the hive, is about 80%. There's water compared to other ingredients that are in the nectar. Mm-hmm. And so they have to dehydrate that honey to get it to 17 to 18% moisture content. And they do that by fanning their wings. And they wow. also do it by sucking it back into their that holding tank and regurgitating it back in, so that process of in and out dehydrates the nectar, and when it gets down to that, you know, 16 to 18% moisture content, they'll cap it off.
Ah,
that's they won't cap it before it's dehydrated that far.
Ariel, I'm curious to know, you know, you hear a lot about bees being endangered. Are they, and why?
Well, they do. They're having they're being affected by a lot of different environmental factors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're kind of like the canary in the coal mine, where they're being affected before we're seeing it other places. So things like the pesticides, especially the neonics, are, you know, things like Roundup are really bad for bees and the other
right.
pollinators as well. And as well as, you know, there was the introduction of the varroa mite, and there are other bacterial and fungal issues that can affect bees. And of course, everybody's heard about, you know, colony collapse disorder. And I think that what you're seeing with colony collapse is that it isn't one thing that's bothering the bees. You get a multitude of things that affect them and weaken them. And that's what's harming bees for the most part. Yeah. I'm trying to distill it down.
Right. Is this where you hear sometimes about bees that stray from their hive and just kind of don't go back, or they can't find it?
Well, yeah, that's another disease, you know, the zombie bees. Yeah. I think they think that's a bacterial problem, a bacterial infection. So, yeah, you get, if the bees are weak, then they're more susceptible to these bacterial, viral, and varroa mites and other things. And those environmental factors. And like for us in our area, we've had 3 years in a row in the fall with major fires and really bad smoky air for weeks at a time. And that smoke, you know, affects the bees. Either they decide we need to flee, there's a fire, or they hunker down, and this, you know, it affects them as well. So there's all these environmental factors are making the bees weaker, and it's harder on them.
I'm wondering how you tell if there are threatening things that have gotten into the hive, or if any bees are sick. Is that something that you would actually need vision for, or are there other ways that you can tell that?
That's a really good point, because I wanted to talk about my other senses and how those come into play. There are a lot of things that I can hear in the hive when I have it open, and also I use a microphone that I put in the inside on the bottom of the hive, so I can hear what's going on even in the winter. I don't have to open the hive and subject the bees to anything.
Cool.
And there are a lot of sounds and information that feedback that would let me know that either they're healthy or something's wrong or something's invaded the hive and they're angry. And my other sense that can give me a sense of something being right or wrong is my sense of smell. The smell of the hive. Each hive has a unique smell. I know my hives and the way they're supposed to smell. And if something's changed, I know that. And then I can use my bee buddy to visually help me figure out, you know, like, how can we narrow this down and figure out what's going on?
So what does a quote, normal, stable hive sound like?
You can hear a hum, but it's not like real high pitched, or it's just this real kind of quiet, continuous humming sound inside the hive. They don't sound agitated. I know if I've been in the hive too long, they let me know by the sound.
I see. And so theoretically, the angry sound would be like a lot of different
louder.
Pitches? Louder?
Louder.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Louder and higher. Yeah. You know when they've had enough. One of the ways you can keep your bees calm if they get agitated is doing what's called smoking them, which is not something you light. What you're doing is you're taking like leaves or, you know, canvas or something else, and you put it in this little funnel that has a bellows on the back, and you can blow the smoke into the hive, and that would absolutely calm them down. It also is like then sticking them blindfolds on them for about 24 hours. So I don't like to smoke my bees unless I need to. But I keep a smoker ready in case I need to.
Right.
So I always
right.
have a smoker running, but I don't smoke my bees unless I absolutely have to.
Well, I guess this isn't something that somebody does if they're allergic to bees.
I have friends who are beekeepers who are allergic, but they always keep an EpiPen on them. And but if you're wildly allergic or you're wildly scared, they also know when you're scared of them. It wouldn't be something to get into if you are really afraid of it. But you wouldn't necessarily have to completely rule it out if you were allergic.
How much area does a hive need?
Not a lot of space. A lot of people in cities have them on the roof of their building. It's not an uncommon, like in Paris, San Francisco, New York, a lot of beekeepers have bees on top of buildings. And no problem at all. They don't need a lot of space. They need forage. So if you're in an area that's a real desert, it makes it much harder for them. But not a big need for space. Though you do need to kind of pay attention if there are a lot of beekeepers in your area and everybody's competing for forage, that could be a problem.
Do bees sting each other?
Bees from other hives trying to get into your hive? Yes. Yeah. There are one of the jobs that bees have is called the guard bee. And those bees are at the entrance of the hive and they will protect the hive from intruders, which could be yellow jackets, hornets, sometimes bees from other hives, if they're starving, if they're hungry. Locally, we have a problem sometimes with commercial bees where they strip all the honey and they feed them sugar water during the winter.
Oh.
And those bees would much rather have honey, so they'll invade a hive and kill all the bees inside and steal the honey. So, yeah. It's serious stuff.
So coming from somebody who would like to get honey from someone who doesn't feed their bees, then apparently, what do I do? Do I just ask, like, do you feed your bees or do you let them eat their own honey? How do you make sure that you're getting what I would think might be a better kind of honey?
If you know a local beekeeper, that would be your best way to get honey. And ask, you know, I would ask, if, you know, do you feed your bees? What do you feed them? And stay away from buying honey in regular stores, like, you know those the honey that comes in a bear and those kind of things. That isn't honey. That's mostly rice syrup, corn syrup, filtered and highly heated. So any of the value that was that's in honey, which is all those beautiful pollens and, you know, all the natural phenols and everything that's in it, it's all destroyed. And it's only diluted. So, yeah, if you can find local beekeepers, like at farmers markets, is a really good way to find local beekeepers. And online, there, you know, you can find good sources for honey. But, yeah, I'd stay away from your, you know, regular grocery store honey.
Can you talk a little bit about beeswax? How do they make that? And presumably it's the same beeswax that's used that you'll see sometimes products with beeswax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when during the spring through the fall, the bees produce the wax, and they produce it on these little plates on their abdomen, where there's like they create a little round flake of wax, and then they take those flakes and, you know, basically kind of chew them up and move, you know, put them in a little ball, and then that's what they use to create the cells for the honeycomb. And they produce those only during honey flow time. So during the winter bees can't produce wax. And then, so it, the way I, you know, people collect that wax, whether it's the cappings from the top of the honeycomb, if you spin the honey out of the comb, or if you just remove the whole honeycomb and the wax together and separate them, beekeepers collect that, and then you melt it down and put it in a little mold, and, you know, so you've got little bricks of beeswax. And it can be used for all sorts of things. Candles, beeswax candles are highly sought after. Like I make lip balm with mine every year. Lately I've been making, like, I'll take a cloth and use an iron and put beeswax on there with a little pine pitch, and those make really great seals for food to put in the refrigerator and things.
Okay. So theoretically,
so there are lots of things you can do.
You can harvest the wax, and that's really not taking anything away from the bees necessarily.
Correct. Yeah.
Is it
the leftover product?
Is it therapeutic? I mean, is it healthy? Like people try to make it seem like it is, or is it just a nice non-harmful thing?
It's not something you eat, but it's non-harmful. You know,
but a lot of people are putting it on
like
their skin.
Like petroleum distillates,
right?
For, you know, like what you would put on in a lot of products that go on your lips, you know, and in cosmetics. You know, the beeswax, like lanolin, or it's just a wax that is very clean and non-toxic. Yeah.
Do you feel like this is
there's another product? Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. Do you feel like this is therapeutic for you?
Yeah, I do. There's so much about keeping the bees that I feel like the whole process, from the time that I spend just sitting and listening to them, smelling the hive, just being in their presence, to the work that I do with them and the products that they produce and what I learn from them, I can't see my life now without having bees in it.
How do bees actually know, like, their handler, you know, like theoretically you're the master of their hives? Would they know the difference if someone else came in?
Absolutely. Yeah. They they've proven that the bees can identify faces.
They
know differences of faces. Their eyes are that good. So they know me. I sit with them every day. I handle them. And I've had a couple people, you know, come and go in the hives with me that were scared. And it was obvious. I mean, the bees know that. They can smell it. They feel it. And they know they're beekeepers.
I want to know, Ariel, what kind of person does this? I'm curious to know, what would you tell someone, say, who says, I want to do it? Because it does kind of sound exciting, although I'm allergic, so I don't think I'd go do it. But yeah. If somebody thought it sounded really cool to do, because it's unusual for a blind person to do it, what would you tell them? Like, what do they need to know? And what kind of person does it take to really keep up on it?
Well, I would tell somebody who was able-bodied, sighted, whoever was interested in beekeeping, that get some knowledge first. There's a learning curve that one needs to feel comfortable managing the bees. And so starting in your own county, seeing if there's a beekeeping association. Most counties throughout the United States have a beekeeping association. And that's a group of people in your county that are all bee nerds and love beekeeping and love helping. I think you can scare yourself right out of the whole thing and spend a lot of money buying equipment, getting the bees, and then end up having it fail. And, you know, you get soured on it after a couple of years if that happens. So doing it with other people really makes a difference and learning. There's lots of great books. There's, you know, your county beekeeping association, you know, get the word out, see if there's somebody else in the area that you know might be a beekeeper, and get some foundation first so you can make decisions in a good way and have a good experience, and also go into it knowing you probably will have loss. I mean, I'd be surprised if you didn't, and that, you know, and what that means now to be a beekeeper, and make decisions about how you want to be a beekeeper. So, and what I mean by that is, I'm somebody who prefers, you know, I won't feed my bees. I won't strip my bees of all their honey. I'm in it for them, not for what I can get out of it. And, you know, there are other people who are in it for the commercial angle, you know, or for the products that they produce. And so there's lots of decisions that you need to make. And it's just like getting a dog or any other animal. It requires maintenance and work. So you got to be ready to make that kind of a commitment.
Do you have other animals? And if so, do the bees kind of leave them alone?
I do have other animals. I have a guide dog, and I'm comfortable with my dogs being out around the hives because I've introduced her to it. She knows not to stand in front of the entrance.
And, I bet she does.
Yeah. You get stung once, you really get the concept. But I didn't really want her to go through that. So, you know, I've taught her not to, you know, move in front of the hives. And none of my dogs have ever been stung by the bees. And, you know, I think a lot of it is the bees are used to seeing them too. But that's the only pets that I have.
How many times did you have a loss before you had, I guess, how long did it take you before you felt like you had a real successful hive?
Since I was blind or since, I mean, the whole time I've been beekeeping?
Well, tell me both. Tell me the first time, you know, and then tell me when you lost your vision.
I just got so lucky in the beginning, you know, in the beginning back in the 70s when I was doing this, because, you know, I didn't have all these external factors that were, you know, like killing bees like they are now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I made a lot of mistakes. You know, equipment then came with what was called a queen excluder, which kept the queen from going up into other parts of the hive, just kept her in the bottom of your hive, which it's a really horrible thing. It's not good for the queen. It's not good for the hive. It's not good for longevity, nothing. And, you know, so, you know, I made all these mistakes in the beginning. And I didn't know about, you know, what worked, what didn't work. And somehow I bumbled through, and they always lived, and I didn't have a problem, except when I had a couple bears that found my hives and destroyed them. That's beyond my control.
Right.
And then I would say after I lost my sight, I had losses, and it had nothing to do with technique or what I was doing. It all had to do with, you know, not being lucky, you know, and smoke in the air and, you know, just conditions, like, you know, I'm sure neighbors used Roundup that made my bees weak and they didn't make it through winter. Winter is always really hard, sort of the acid test of, you know, are they going to make it, is getting through winter.
I see.
But, yeah. So I just feel really lucky this year. I am 2 for 2. I've got 2 strong hives coming out of winter.
Yes, well, that is very lucky, actually. Ariel, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? I guess it sounds like it's on the borderline sort of difficult starting out with bee raising now because of all the complications that can happen.
Yeah, that's true, but at the same time, there's many more people doing it. So find somebody who's a beekeeper and let them, you know, learn from them before you do it yourself. You know, go out and see if they'll let you go in the hive with them, their hives with them, and start learning about it. And then you'll, you know, I can guarantee you, if you get the bug, get bitten by the bee bug, you'll get so excited and entrenched in who they are that it will really light the fire.
Well, thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it, and I wish you good luck. I know there's tends to be a lot of fires there. I wish you good luck for the future of our bees.
Thank you
so much. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. My name is Sam. If you'd like to be on our email list, you may email us at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. That's disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Again, thanks to Amber Johnson for setting up this program. And thanks to Charlene Dahl, who has been my trusty research person for a long time. Good research people are hard to find. So, thank you, Charlene. I guess that's all we have for tonight. And everyone, take care and stay well.
KFAI.org.